We'll talk about new state legislation that would change the way teachers can be fired or disciplined, and other proposed changes affecting Wisconsin schools this hour. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, May the 23rd. Senate Bill 95 proposes modifying 10 state mandates, including allowing school boards to use teacher evaluations, which include the results of standardized tests of students, as part of the reason for dismissing or disciplining teachers. The bill received a public hearing in the state legislature last week, but critics say without enough notice. So we will discuss the proposals more this hour, plus we will talk about some other developments in the news last week regarding expanding the school voucher program and a proposal to use some of the newly found state revenue to scale back education funding cuts. And we welcome your questions and views for our guest at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page as we talk about the future of education in the state of Wisconsin. Our guest is Alan Borsuk. He is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and is the education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about there's so many things in this Senate Bill 95. Let's start with the changing the way teachers can be fired or disciplined in the state of Wisconsin. Is this a big change?
Well, like so many things, ask me in 5 years because I don't know how it will play out. It's a big change. My guess is it won't be as dramatic as some people fear, but nonetheless, it's a substantial issue. And frankly, I'm sympathetic with the fact that this came up without very much warning as far as the introduction of the bill and the public hearing. I agree with those who said if it had been given more notice, there would have been a far bigger crowd. It was fairly a small crowd at the public hearing last week in Madison. Until 2 years ago, Wisconsin had one of the strongest firewalls in the country separating student performance on state tests and other measures from teacher evaluations. Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, had subjected specifically to ridicule at the time they were starting the race to the top process. And now this would bring Wisconsin into line with a lot of other states that are doing this, but I don't think anyone knows how it's going to play out.
Yeah, well, so what is the concern about using student performance or standardized test results in teacher evaluations?
Well, fairly simply, just that how a student does on a test may not be very much a gauge of how well a teacher is doing, that there's so many other factors that are involved in a classroom. And in Wisconsin, you have the particular factor that the state tests are given in the fall each year, which is, you know, just a couple months into the school year, and you say, wait a minute, I just started teaching. I'm not responsible for these results that come out in the late spring each year. I think everyone, even the most adamant supporter of doing teacher evaluations using student data, realize that it shouldn't be the only measure. But the process of coming up with a reliable way of doing this is far from complete.
So it used to be you can't use this at all. This
right.
bill would say you can use it as part of a reason for firing
right.
a teacher.
Yeah, no, it specifically says there have to be multiple measures. Nonetheless, student data would be something that could be used in assigning, in disciplining or dropping a teacher, demoting a teacher, firing a teacher, and that's currently prohibited even under the changes that were made. I believe that was in the spring of 2009, that there was some liberalization or conservatization, depending on how you look at it, of the law and using student records. This would take it to the step of actually saying it's okay to use it as a factor in deciding what to do with teachers.
Another measure in Senate Bill 95 would change the way the SAGE program works. Apparently, it would allow school districts more flexibility in the way they would implement this law on smaller class sizes.
Which I don't think, some of the provisions in here, most of the provisions in here, I know the sponsors of the law say these are things that they were being asked to do by school districts and school administrators, and some of the provisions are not as controversial as others. That one is probably not so controversial because it's simply a matter that the SAGE money, the state's very popular class size reduction law for kindergarten through third grade, generally for low-income students, the money just isn't stretching far enough. It's a combination of the program becoming more popular and the state, of course, tightening the purse strings. And so districts are looking for ways to do whatever they can with it. So this just gives them more flexibility. I don't think it's as controversial as some other things.
Okay, but in essence, it means that some classrooms, which should be smaller, won't be smaller.
Well, the rule originally was 15-1 in those early grades, and I don't know of any parents anywhere who wouldn't be in favor of smaller class sizes for their children. And there is some research; it's not as overwhelming in its weight as some people might think. That says that smaller class sizes do help, especially with high needs kids. So instead of 15-1 already, you're starting to see 18-1. This would allow those kind of changes. In some schools, I believe, instead of kindergarten through third grade, they could do just kindergarten and first grade, that kind of flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Another aspect of this bill, it would allow extracurricular sports to be used to meet the physical education requirements. Is that that big of a deal?
I don't honestly know quite how to rate that on the controversy scale. I think, again, administrators, principals, school boards are trying to seek any way they can to stretch their dollars, to stretch their ability to schedule and so on, because they're getting so squeezed statewide by their budget situations. In this case, I don't know. I was not much of an athlete when I was in high school, but I wouldn't want to tell you that the guys who were playing football or any sport like that weren't engaged in something that was physical education. They were doing something. So I don't know how.
Right. Yeah. Well, so, but what would be the point of even proposing this?
You want to know the truth? I'm not clear on that myself. It seems like a fairly small change. So why put it into a bill like this? Again, I think that everything's being done in the name of more flexibility, more options in how to schedule things, allowing things that weren't counted as academic subjects to be counted as academic subjects.
Yeah. Well, what else in this package of bills would be one that would raise more eyebrows?
The state provides money for school libraries to every public school in the state, and it's restricted to a large degree to being used to purchase books and such. I believe currently 25% of it can be used to purchase computers and other media, but not more than 25%. This would eliminate that provision so that more money could be used to buy high-tech apparatus or gear to be used in schools. I know a lot of school librarians are concerned that this will just erode the nature of their media centers, and obviously that's a whole field that's changing so greatly because of the way computers are impacting education and computing and impacting life in general. But nonetheless, they think this would be a step away from maintaining a strong, what you would traditionally call a library function in the school. So that has generated controversy among school librarians, I know. There's other provisions that give more flexibility on how to handle pupils who are expelled from a charter school, some provisions related to busing contracts and what dates tax levies need to be posted by, and some other stuff that, that actually isn't too controversial.
Mm-hmm. And
the teacher performance pay thing is by far the spotlight issue here.
We shouldn't be concerned about this this aspect here to regarding special education services, contracting out special education services?
That's a good question. Mm. So much of it depends on how it plays out. Does it open the door for more privatization? That would certainly, frankly, be in line with everything the Republicans have been pushing in the last few months. I don't know how much of a difference this would make. There is a lot under Title I, the federal bill. There's a lot of contracting already to private services that are nonprofits that provide special ed services in schools. This covers a variety of services. I'm reading, I got it right in front of me, orientation, mobility training, educational interpreters, audiologists, speech therapists. I think it gives, again, a wider range of options to schools, but they're already doing a lot of this, so I'm not sure it's going to be that dramatic a change.
We are talking with Alan Borsuk. He is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. He is also education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we are talking with him about new legislation that would change the way schools work in Wisconsin. And we will also talk with him about other developments in the news regarding the school voucher program or proposals to expand the school voucher program. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for him on some of these changes that are moving through the state legislature. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What do you think about the direction that education is headed in the state of Wisconsin? Is this the right direction or the wrong direction? What concerns or questions do you have? Checking our weather forecast for today. It's going to be a mostly cloudy day with scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms. Highs today will be in the upper 50s to upper 60s in northern Wisconsin. High temperatures will get into the 70s in the southern part of the state. Currently in Superior, light rain reported and 47 degrees. Wausau, overcast and 57. Green Bay is clear and 62. In Eau Claire, it's cloudy, 60 degrees. La Crosse, mostly cloudy and 60. Madison, overcast, 64. In Milwaukee, scattered clouds and 61 degrees. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 21 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, May the 23rd. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. And coming up after 5, a rebroadcast. Wisconsin has many traffic laws that say where, when, and how fast you can drive. How well do you know Wisconsin traffic laws? You can test yourself as Ben and his guest discuss the rules of the road after 5 o'clock this afternoon at Issue with Ben Marins. This is a rebroadcast because today is a furlough day for many at the University of Wisconsin Extension, but we're here live and you can call in and join our conversation this hour about education in the state of Wisconsin and some proposals to change the way schools work and the education system works in the state of Wisconsin. We're talking with Alan Borsuk, who is Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I had other issues that I wanted to talk to you about, Alan Borsuk, but we have full lines, so let me see what our listeners want to ask about and go to Yetta in Nina. Hello, Yetta.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You had mentioned that other states do use students' test scores in their teacher evaluations. And I know some of the problems we face in Wisconsin is test burnout. The kids take the MAP test, WKCE, ASVAB, ACT, and the only one that carries any weight is the ACT. So on a lot of the others, there are kids who will just put C for every answer. And for that student, there's no repercussion, but it makes the school's test scores look low, and it would reflect poorly on the teacher. And I was wondering if other states that have this have found a way around those issues.
That's a really good question. I agree that test burnout can be an issue, that especially for a student who's not that motivated about school in general, why should they be motivated, especially about taking a test that has no consequences to them? There are states that have some consequences, even some schools in Wisconsin, when they're taking the state WKCE exams. The problem is worse, most people feel, with 10th graders, the highest grade that takes that test. So they'll say if you are rated as proficient on the KCEs, you don't have to take a final exam, or you get some other privilege, you get to exemption from some other requirements. So there's some effort to try to give it some consequence. I don't know if anyone's entirely solved that problem. There's also schools, including Milwaukee, that treat test taking as a matter of school pride. They'll have rallies, they'll have speakers, they'll have special breakfast, try to get the kids invested in it. But it is a serious issue, and I don't think there's any proposal on the table to make, for example, the KCEs have more consequences individually for kids, which might give them more motivation. So I don't know if anyone's got a good answer to that. There are dramatic changes coming in the state testing system, and probably the state testing systems all across the country, but they're still a couple years away. We're going to have the same KCE system for at least the next school year, and at the pace they're going, it may be longer than that.
Anything else, Yetta?
No, I guess that's it. I'm surprised that at the hearing, more people weren't given a chance to discuss why the test sometimes are not a good measurement of what teachers are up to. Best practices for teachers would have you doing projects with the kids. They'd be investigating stuff. They'd be looking into things. I think at this point, teachers who give multiple choice tests as their final assessment for kids are sort of viewed as being outdated or doing something that's not worthwhile for kids. So to turn around and then use that as the measurement of how teachers are doing, I think it's kind of a backwards approach. It's almost asking teachers to go back to a model that we know is not effective for kids.
The problem from the standpoint of accountability or, the parents and especially politicians and such is nobody's come up with an alternative. Nobody's come up with a way using portfolios or something which you can say, "Not tell me, how are the kids doing?" Because it's very hard to quantify using those kind of systems. The test scores have the virtue of being very quantifiable. Howard Gardner, who's basically the person who created the theory of multiple intelligences, a very respected figure from Harvard, he told me a few years ago, and he's very anti-testing, shall we say, and he said the problem among those of us who are critical of testing is we've never come up with a good alternative in which we can go to the public and say, here's how the kids are doing. There's some hope that in the more sophisticated world of testing that's coming, more use of computers to hone in on an individual child's ability, that better things will emerge. But so far, that's the operative word is emerging. No one's there yet.
Thank you, Yetta. Moving on now to Philip in Milwaukee. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Borsuk. I've been a follower of your columns over many years. I was president of the union at MATC when we got collective bargaining in 63. We were the first in higher education. I believe in evaluation, but it should not be based on welfare for corporate testing companies. They have nothing to do with the competency based evaluation. My terminal degree is in vocational technical education. From 1980 on, MATC had lots of problems with administrators, as you're undoubtedly aware.
Yeah,
and it was the faculty and staff that kept the place going because they believed in the mission of the school. Vocational technical education is competency based, and I believe that there should be evaluation of teachers, but it should be two or three way evaluation. Students, supervisors, and they evaluate each other on fairly acceptable objective standards. And these standards should be set up by the people doing the evaluation, the students, the teachers, the supervisors, and perhaps even evaluating the chief executive officer, because I think the board certainly can't evaluate them day to day. If the faculty and students are involved in that, I don't think there would be the problems that MATC has had over the years. I'd like your comments.
Well, let me look a little more broadly than MATC. If there's going to be a system that uses student performance data that's regarded as fair and reliable, it's going to have to be a lot better than any system we have right now. There's an awful lot of work going on around the country to try to get to that point, but like so many things we're talking about, it's in process at best. Ultimately, I think everyone knows there are good teachers and there are teachers who aren't so good. Just remember your own school experiences and you say, hey, that was a great teacher, and I learned a lot. And so to say how much are kids learning from this teacher and not simply, you know, is the teacher in the classroom and doing a relatively reliable job, but is there really learning going on, is in itself a worthy goal. How to make that operative is a trickier matter. But to say I want to judge this teacher by how well the kids are doing is something that's actually very appealing. And whether test data can play a part in that, you know, there's a lot of work that's shown that one famous study from Tennessee that kids who had good teachers as they were evaluated for 3 years in a row ended up a half a year ahead of kids who didn't have good teachers in that period and didn't have the better teachers. And that you could measure that by how they were doing in the classes. So to say, show me how much progress your kids are making. Are they making a year's progress in a year? Are they making more than a year? Are they making less than a year? That in itself, at least conceptually, isn't such a bad way to evaluate teachers. How to come up with the data that's reliable in doing that is a more complex matter.
We are talking about a new plan in the state legislature that would allow standardized test scores to be used in disciplining and firing teachers, and other proposed changes to Wisconsin schools that are being considered by state lawmakers. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, who is the education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Alan Borsak. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are holding a public radio public hearing on a bill that would, among other things, allow standardized test scores to be used in disciplining and dismissing Wisconsin public school teachers. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is now 6:36 on this Monday, May the 23rd. We are talking about these education changes that are proposed and moving through the state legislature. We'll also talk some about the proposal to expand the school choice or school voucher program in Wisconsin. The school voucher program in Racine was the subject of a press conference last week where public school officials called the program morally wrong and potentially crippling. We will ask our guest about that as well. And we welcome your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Alan Borsak. He is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School, and he is education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Let's talk a little bit about, Alan Borsak, this proposal to expand the school choice voucher program. Currently, it's for low-income parents and students in Milwaukee only, but one bill would expand that to the entire county of Milwaukee County. There's other legislation to remove the low-income requirement, to remove that cap, and expand the program to other cities, including Racine, Beloit, Green Bay, and others. Public school officials in Racine last week said this is a bad idea, morally wrong, potentially crippling. What's your assessment?
Well, I'm going to dodge being too judgmental because I do try to go down kind of I try to have a journalistic approach mm-hmm. to it a little more. So let me stick to what I think is likely to happen. I think lifting the cap in Milwaukee, which has been at 22,500, is virtually a done deal. I can't see anything that will stop that from happening. And just to clarify, the expansion in Milwaukee is not to the suburbs in terms of the kids who could take part, but it's the schools that could take part.
Yes.
Currently, to get a voucher to a religious or private school in Milwaukee, you have to be a low-income child living in the city and attending a school in the city, and this would allow schools in Milwaukee County, which would include potentially up to, I think it's in the mid-40s of Catholic schools and other private schools that are in the suburbs. The two really controversial things are going to be the income standard for getting a voucher, which Governor Walker, it's really, frankly, really dramatic proposal. I mean, a fairly amazing proposal to lift entirely the income requirement. So it wouldn't be for low-income kids. It would be for any kids. It would be phased in bit by bit over a number of years, but that would be the outcome. And that's really a major change in the nature of the program. And then this question that came up just in the last 2 weeks, kind of out of the, well, I wouldn't say out of the blue because there was talk about it, but nonetheless, it really wasn't on the table of expanding to who knows how many places, but the governor specifically said in a speech in Washington, Racine, Green Bay, and Beloit, all three of those are places that have some concentrations of low-income people and some concentrations of fairly weak results academically. Racine has some schools that are really every bit in the same boat as Milwaukee, for example, and so does Beloit, maybe Green Bay less so. It's no surprise at all that this would encounter major opposition from the public school leaders because they've seen what's happened in Milwaukee where the public school leadership is increasingly upset about the impact that the voucher program is having on them, not only in terms of lost students, but financial impact. So the superintendent in Green Bay said this would be a dagger in the heart of public education. There was that press conference in Racine. I don't know if the groundwork has been laid to really start programs up there, especially if there's an effort to do it by this September, which some of the advocates involved want to do that. But to launch a program solidly, where you have any degree of careful monitoring of whether this is a quality school and whether the finances are in order and whether their academic programs are in order, whether they're accredited programs, man, I can't see how that's going to be done by this September. And I don't know if politically the groundwork's been laid, so I'm kind of dubious whether that's going to fly.
Let me take a caller. Greg in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Greg.
Mr. Borsak, I've lived in Milwaukee since 1978, and prior to the voucher program, I recall the Milwaukee Public Schools being proclaimed as the best large city public school system in the country. When the voucher system was introduced, there were warnings that it was going to destroy public schools in Milwaukee. Now they're talking about tearing down public schools in Milwaukee, and I think it's time you went back and did a thorough historical evaluation of this voucher system and its effect on the public school system, and that's the kind of evaluation that I think we need here.
Well, I understand what you're saying. The history is, I would suggest, more complicated than that, and what role the vouchers have played in it is hard to say. I mean, Milwaukee also has some of the, and Wisconsin as a whole, not just Milwaukee, but some of these other cities, Racine, Green Bay, Beloit, Madison, have the worst gaps in the country between white kids and black kids. There are astonishingly awful results for African-American students in many, many schools in Milwaukee. Hispanic students aren't doing very well. Low-income students as a whole aren't doing well. Unfortunately, the worst results are among African-Americans. And that's not a problem that started with the vouchers. That goes back, you know, that was really building through the 80s and 90s. I think that's one of the reasons the voucher program grew up was in the name of greater social equity. Has it worked out that way? This is the first year that there have been results to compare voucher school students and MPS students on the state test scores, and they did, frankly, about the same. In fact, in some measures, the voucher kids did worse. So There's some terrific voucher schools, charter schools, MPS schools, but there's an awful lot of schools that are not thriving in all three streams. And the underlying factors and causes and the dimensions of the problems, frankly, go beyond vouchers or charters or MPS or whatever. MPS was facing huge problems long before the vouchers came along.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Moving next to Kristen in Madison. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I've been a teacher for 16 years, and I've worked in four states. And Wisconsin, I think, is one of the most complicated. I think as far as vouchers, I guess can correct me if I'm wrong, but in a lot of cases with a voucher or a charter school, they're not required to keep you if you have behavioral issues or special education issues. So, you know, they can just let you go. As far as SAGE goes, I'm a huge fan of SAGE. I've taught in SAGE, and my children go to SAGE schools. I think it's wonderful. I wouldn't like to see the numbers go up. My biggest issue is with the WKCE as an evaluation tool. I don't mind being evaluated using a standardized test. I think it ought to be a good one. I'm a special ed teacher, and one of our biggest concerns is that we fought for years to get our kids back into the classroom, but they don't test well, and they probably never will because of their disabilities. But probably 90% of the disabilities and related services, you know, speech, things like that, those kids all have average or above average IQs, and yet we know they're not going to test well. So our concern is that teachers, regular ed teachers, won't want them in their classrooms because it's going to bring their scores down. And, you know, there's all these questions like, well, we take it in the fall, so if it's a fourth grade student, who do you evaluate, the third grade teacher or the fourth grade teacher? If they're a special ed student, do you evaluate the special ed teacher also? I mean, I work with kids with behavioral disabilities, and a lot of them just refuse to take a test or fill in numbers or do all this ridiculousness. And I disagree that there aren't good measures out there. You know, we do quick things, running records for reading. They take 2 minutes. I can tell you in 2 minutes where a kid's reading. Even the MAP testing, which is popular in Wisconsin, is pretty accurate. So, you know, I wonder what the guest thinks about those kinds of assessments and why couldn't they be used.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Kristen. Alan Borsuk?
Well, she hit on a lot of issues there. Just to pick a couple of them, the MAPS testing she mentioned and some of the other styles of testing, I think that's the direction things are going to go in the next couple years. The KCEs are the tests that everybody loves to hate, and for fairly good reasons. In my mind, this business of giving it in the fall has not worked out at all well, and I'm betting that that'll be gone within a couple years, that it'll be much more of a spring testing or spread out over the year in smaller doses the way MAP testing is done, something like that. But there is a revolution coming in testing, and I don't think anyone's going to be sentimental about the passing of the KCEs when it comes. Special ed issues are obviously hugely complicated. A lot of the pressure to test special ed kids along with general ed kids is actually from the federal government. It's from the No Child Left Behind law that goes back to 2001. And in many cases, the special ed advocates are some of the biggest proponents of that law, because for the first time, teachers and schools are being held to some standards, you know, to some heat's being put on them to see that special ed kids are learning. So it has some real upsides, but it does create a lot of complications. How that would play out in terms of a system in which there was a performance pay incentive for teachers based on test scores, that strikes me as a really important question, and it does need attention, because you can't evaluate kids without having some sense of who those kids are, and not all kids were created alike.
Let me ask you before we let you go about this week. The Joint Finance Committee in the state legislature is scheduled to take up the proposed $840 million cut in school aid. And we have some Democrats in the legislature saying that the state should use the $630-some million in newly found tax revenue to try to lessen the cuts to schools, and even some Republican legislative leaders saying they are working on some sort of plan to maybe reduce the cuts in school aid. How do you see that playing out?
My guess is there'll be some mitigation of what's there, that it'll be not quite as severe in the end as in Governor Walker's proposal. I mean, he called for a 5.5% cut in the amount that school districts are allowed, statewide, in the amount that school districts are allowed to spend on kids, the revenue cap. And that's really, really a dramatic step. It plays out as more than 5.5% in terms of the staffing levels in many schools. And I think there are Republicans who are a little nervous about that, shall we say, also. So my guess is some of that money will end up getting used and there'll be some improvement. It's not going to turn around the basic picture. There's still going to be major cuts in education spending, which is a historic reversal of what's gone on for many years. Obviously, the Republicans feel strongly about cutting state spending. The Democrats and teachers are taking, a super strong stand that this is the future of Wisconsin, and that's going to be a dominating issue come these recall elections in July and on into 2012 and the state legislative elections end 2014, the next governor's election, if there's not a recall next year. It's nuclear war for everybody, and it's going to be really intense. So it isn't going to dramatically change the picture.
And we will talk more about some of those issues coming up in our State Capitol Report. Alan Borsak, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
Alan Borsak, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. He is an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking with us about some of the proposals in the state legislature that would change the way Wisconsin schools operate and various education policies. We thank him for being with us, and we thank you for listening, and we thank Rob Ferret and Bill Martins for producing this program. Checking our weather forecast for today, it's going to be mostly cloudy with scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms. Highs will be in the upper 50s to upper 60s in northern Wisconsin, into the 70s in the southern part of the state. Currently around the state, in Superior, it is cloudy now and 48 degrees. Wausau, clouds and 57. Oshkosh, clear and 63 degrees. Eau Claire, overcast and 60. Scattered clouds in Madison and 64. In Milwaukee, scattered clouds and 61. La Crosse, hit by that tornado yesterday, mostly cloudy and 60 degrees. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. It's time for the Monday Morning Wake-Up Call, a new feature every Monday at this time when a guest will issue a wake-up call for all of us on an issue that matters. Perhaps it's an issue that we haven't heard much about, something that is percolating beneath the surface. Today's wake-up call comes from the AFL-CIO. The leader of the National AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, addressed the National Press Club on Friday and issued a wake-up call to all candidates and politicians on the state and national levels to work in the interest of working people or lose the support of labor. And that includes Democrats. We will talk about Trumka's wake-up call with the Secretary-Treasurer of the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO. Stephanie Bloomingdale joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
We saw this headline in the Huffington Post on Friday: Richard Trumka threatens to abandon Democrats in 2012 unless they fight harder for labor. Is that what Richard Trumka was doing?
Well, I think President Trumka was really issuing a wake-up call to both to the Democratic Party, and saying that we in the labor movement are going to expect more from the candidates that we endorse and support, because so much is at stake. We are losing ground with the middle class. People are suffering in terms of the kind of jobs they have, and we need to do all we can to restore America where there is more fairness and balance in our economy.
Yeah, are Democrats not fighting hard enough for working people?
Well, I would say here in Wisconsin over the last, this spring, I would say that the Democrats here have been fighting very hard, and we are very, very pleased and think that the fabulous 14, those 14 senators who drew a line in the sand and said, Scott Walker, we will not participate in this kind of immoral and unethical vote to take away collective bargaining. We are very pleased with them, and really they have emerged as heroes of the middle class, and really they are the kind of Democrats that we hope that other Democrats across the nation look towards.
Mm-hmm. In Wisconsin, the AFL-CIO is much more upset at Republicans?
In Wisconsin, of course, we have sort of the symbolic leader of the movement to crush the union movement and crush the middle class, which is Scott Walker. And so we've gotten a lot of attention. He's got a lot of attention from this. And so people really have been able to wake up and see, unveil his agenda, Scott Walker's agenda, which is really to concentrate his own power and to take power away from working people by not allowing them to have a collective bargaining process. And, to reward the Koch brothers and others who have put him into office and to make way for just really wholesale privatization for his buddies.
Yeah, let me get you to react to one thing that Richard Trumka said. Budget proposals unveiled in Washington and in state capitals across the country revealed a despicable canvas of cruelty. He says that, in essence, he said, watch out to the powerful political forces that are seeking to silence working people. Talk a little bit more about that. What is this despicable canvas of cruelty?
Well, I think that, he really puts it out there in a stark vision, in a stark way, because what we've seen around the state, whether it be in Michigan, Ohio, Missouri, Maine, is a power grab by these governors that thought that with the 2010 wave of Republicans sweeping the country in state houses, that they could quickly implement agendas that would completely keep their power together in such a way that they could make any decisions they wanted to. And we've seen this in Wisconsin. We've seen what Scott Walker wants to do with collective bargaining. We've seen what he wants to do with the voter ID, which would disenfranchise many people that he sees are the voters that do not traditionally vote for him or his party. And so we're seeing these outrageous acts, and really they do lead to more cruelty in our country because people are losing ground. They're losing Democratic ground. We're losing wealth. We have the highest the concentration of wealth in our country is growing to really dangerous levels. And it's up to working people to stand up to that. It's up to working people. It's up to the union movement to really stand up and say, we want our democracy back, and we want more fairness in our economy for all working people.
We'll need to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us and for helping the AFL-CIO issue this wake-up call.
Thank you.
Stephanie Bloomingdale, Secretary Treasurer of the Wisconsin State AFL-CIO, talking about the wake-up call issued by Richard Trumka on Friday, where he said that politicians on the state and national levels need to work harder in the interest of working people or they will lose the support of labor, and that includes Democrats. Thanks to Rob Ferret, to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.